You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Thursday, June 18th, 2009, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hi, everyone.
And happy 4th of July to everybody.
That's right. This episode
is that what today is?
We'll be going up on the 4th. We're pre-recording because of the TAM and other things, so we're a little behind the times. But this is the 4th, July 4th episode.
That means today's my birthday.
Happy birthday, Bob.
Happy birthday.
It came earlier this year.
I didn't even get you anything.
That's all right. I'm used to it.
You're 39, right, Bob?
And holding years.
39 to what power?
So is that all you got for today, Evan?
Oh, yeah. So 1826. So guess who died on this day in 1826?
Jesus.
Close.
1826.
John Adams.
Yes, John Adams, but also his dear friend Thomas Jefferson.
And Thomas Jefferson,
they both
right.
died on the same day of year, actually. But in the world of science, Thomas Jefferson made some contributions. He had interests in mathematics, natural sciences. He corresponded with Joseph Priestley.
The guy from Beverly Hills, 90210?
Yes, that's right.
He invented oxygen, right?
Jefferson would collect and classify fossils, too. So he was a budding amateur scientist at the time, but then this whole revolution thing turning, he had to write the Declaration of Independence or something, and politics kind of got in the way of things for him. So,
well, we have a few interesting news items for this evening. The first one is the best proof to date of ancient water on Mars.
Ooh.
When you say ancient, why would you refer to it as ancient?
Because it's very old.
3 billion years old.
But yeah, how old is the water on the Earth?
It was liquid a long time ago. Now it's like gone, evaporated away. That's why they're calling it ancient.
University of Colorado at Boulder research team found what they're calling the first definitive evidence of shorelines on Mars. They think that they found a deep and ancient lake. So not that the water itself is ancient, but the lake, the water existed on the surface in ancient Mars. So they think it was, they estimate about 3 billion years ago.
Wow.
This lake covered about 80 square miles and was up to 1,500 feet deep, which they say is roughly the size of Lake Champlain, which borders the U.S. and Canada. So I guess they were able to identify features, geological features that mark it as an actual shoreline found along a broad delta, including a series of alternating ridges, troughs, thought to be surviving remnants of beach deposits.
So, Steve, if there was any kind of bacterial life in that water, that's where they would find remnants of that.
Exactly. So that's one of the indications there that if that's a good place to look for, you know, fossils of ancient life on Mars or even existing life on Mars. You know, maybe under the surface there may still be, you know, some bacterial equivalent or something like this. They're calling this evidence unambiguous. I don't know if that's overcalling it or not, but that's what they're saying.
Right.
I found an interesting comment somebody made, and he was saying that this was kind of silly because any evidence of life on Earth in rocks that old have been hard to come by. They're heavily altered and is often disputed. So he thinks that looking there for life doesn't make sense because it's such ancient rock that even if there's anything there, it would be altered in some way or just not definitive. And he didn't think it was a very good place to look considering how ancient it was.
I mean, that is a good point. I mean, for the same reason that we could say there was water there 3 billion years ago, we could say those rocks are 3 billion years old. So yeah, maybe it isn't such a good place to look.
Yeah,
but I guess the thinking is that in that area there still may be some subsurface water, and that life may have survived long past, you know, the surface lake. You know, maybe
right? And that
into
that
more recent
sense.
Times. Yeah, very interesting. All the more reason why we need to get our ass to Mars.
It's terrible.
No, it's
never
pretty bad.
That again.
I've heard worse.
Yeah, but we're not going to go there. We're not sending people there soon. It's definitely not happening.
Not anytime
soon.
Not until we resolve the radiation problem.
Well, the next news item, I know you guys have all seen this, the CNN footage of the miraculous smoke ring UFO.
Oh, it's miraculous, all right.
Oh, yeah.
It's a ring. It's made of smoke.
Inexplicable.
In the sky. obviously a UFO.
Well, how do you explain this one, Steve?
Well, there's a couple of explanations. What's interesting is that this was filmed over a city in Virginia. You know what it's called?
King's Dominion.
It was over at King's Dominion, which is a theme park in Doswell, Virginia.
Oh,
Doswell.
So we have Roswell to Mexico, and now we have Doswell, Virginia.
Hey, look at your keyboard.
The poor man's
Roswell. The D is kind of close to the R. Maybe it was just a typo.
Next, it's going to be Schmoswell.
Schmoswell, Connecticut.
Toswell, there's Foswell, all these keys next to the R.
Well, Steve, more important than that, what was the smoke ring directly over?
Yeah, it was directly over a fake volcano at the theme park.
Hello.
Coincidence? I mean, that is almost literally a smoking gun of a possible cause there.
It's a smoking volcano.
A smoking volcano, absolutely. I mean, you know, smoke rings happen. It's what can happen if the air pressures and whatnot are correct. Interestingly, when researching this piece, I found a similar media flap about a smoke ring UFO back in 2003.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, this one was investigated, and it looks virtually identical to the one that we're seeing on the video now. Maybe this one's a little bit darker. And there, the eyewitnesses reported that the smoke ring occurred after a lightning strike of a transformer, causing the transformer to explode, and it sent up this smoke ring. So, you know, any kind of explosion like that can generate a smoke ring, potentially.
So, Steve, under the conditions, the weather of that day, there didn't seem to be a lot of wind.
Yeah.
There was cloud cover.
Mm-hmm.
And what you're describing is, you're just saying that there actually is a very large gray smoke ring, you know, maybe 300 to 500 feet above where the person is filming it.
Yeah, and you could see it kind of rising and dissipating.
But they claim that was a UFO.
Well, the media are hyping it as a mystery. I don't think, however, honestly, the UFO community is jumping all over this. This one's a little thin, even for them. What was most amusing was the woman that they found to interview for the local news, who actually doesn't think that it's a UFO. She thinks it's a sign from God. You guys see that interview?
Yeah, divine intervention.
Yeah.
She was something
potato,
else.
Potato, potato.
She had a couple quotes that struck me. She said that smoke usually looks smoky. Well, yeah, but unless it's in a dense ring 500 or 800 feet away from you, it's not going to look very smoky in that case.
Right.
She also said that this was a perfect circle.
The band?
Well, yeah, you know, smoke ring, you know, smoke ring. Rings are circular. So what? That's not very compelling. If you want a good example, go onto YouTube and look up smoke rings on the Playa Burning Man 2008. Punch some of those words in. You'll get this video. You'll see a smoke ring being created, rising in the air, and looking almost identical to the one that they show in this video.
Yeah, I know. It's not an uncommon phenomenon. It really isn't. I mean, it's a known entity, really.
Plus, the amusement park is saying, oh, yeah, it's ours. Our volcano did it. They're admitting that their volcano did this.
So volcano.
It's another case of
Jesus, you know, whatever.
Right. It's another case of just something that people don't have they don't have experience with.
Here's my beef with the whole thing. CNN, okay. I mean, really, is this really a front page story? I mean, this is on the day that it came up. This was on the front page as you click on the CNN homepage. I mean, come on. Was it that slow a news day that you had to throw this up?
So.
Bottom line, I bet they got lots of hits.
Well, yeah, we're talking about it. I mean, anytime you can put UFO in the title or have someone saying on camera that there was a sign from God, I mean, that's journalism gold. I mean, you know, what are you going to do? That's not going away anytime soon.
Sounds like journalism fool's gold.
Quick follow-up to the Merseyside UFO. We had corrected the story that won't go away. But the thing is, there were multiple lights floating in the sky that many people reported. It wasn't positively identified. you know, we had confused that with a separate incident on the same day. But since that, since we did the follow-up on that item, we've gotten multiple emails from listeners who say that now it's pretty sure that these were floating lanterns and that there was somebody who admitted to sort of lighting and setting these things aloft.
And we've talked about floating lanterns being mistaken for UFOs in England before.
It definitely needs to be on the short list whenever you have just slowly floating multiple bright lights. That's until you've ruled that out. Now you can't say that it's even anything unusual or worthy of further investigation.
Not unusual,
right?
And I don't know about you guys, but I'm getting pummeled with people who are making fun of me for my mispronunciation of Merseyside.
Yeah. I guess it's Mersey, like Jersey.
Mersey, yeah, Mersey, or Quincy.
Jersey. Well, I didn't say it, so no one's making fun of me.
Jay, people are always making fun of you. It doesn't matter what you say.
That's true. That was quite a delusional statement there, Jay. The next news item is about an FDA warning about Zicam. I know we've talked about Zicam before. It is marketed as a homeopathic product, but it actually contains detectable, real, biologically active amounts of zinc.
Oh.
And the nasal spray and nasal swab versions of Zicam, both adult and pediatric, the FDA has issued warnings about that because the FDA has received 130 reports of anosmia, which is a loss of smell, either a decrease or a complete loss of smell following the use of Zicam.
Whoa.
I wonder what that's attributed
to. And they think it's due directly to toxicity from the zinc because it's people can rarely get anosmia from a severe viral upper respiratory infection. But when you get it from zinc, which has been reported, so it's a known entity, zinc causing toxicity to the nasal mucosa, the epithelium cells there. When that happens, it usually is accompanied by a burning sensation, and it happens pretty quickly after the use of the zinc or the zinc-based product. So the reports, the FDA concluded, fit better with zinc toxicity than just anosmia from some other cause. So yes, it's a correlation, but there's reason to think that there's a causation between the Zicam and the anosmia.
Is it permanent, Steve?
It can be permanent.
Oh,
it
no.
can be Ouch. Permanent, which is the, which was the real reason for concern by the FDA, is that, you know, it's a cold. The whether or not Zicam or zinc works for relieving cold symptoms is still up in the air. But there are some studies which show that, it might take the edge off your symptoms if you use it right away, you know. But still, it's a cold. The colds last for 7 days. You know, they're self-limiting. They get better. It's not worth risking a permanent side effect like a complete loss of smell.
Now, this wouldn't happen if they just shut down homeopathic medicines.
It does raise the question of how homeopathic medicines are regulated, which we'll get to in a second. But just wanted to talk about anosmia for a second. It may seem like an inconvenience, but actually there's serious problems that result from this. Because if you can't smell, you can't tell when your food has gone bad, when your milk has gone sour. You really have no way of assessing the safety of the food that you're eating or drinking.
You have no idea, like, how long a fart lingers. So, like, if your girl's coming back in the room, you're in an awkward position there.
That's true. It's a serious threat to your relationships. That's true. And your social
status. That's the biggest problem, I think.
Social implications are huge.
You can't smell smoke if there's a fire.
And you can't see smoke rings either.
And or if there's a gas leak, you wouldn't be able to smell it.
On the plus side, cleaning the kitty litter box is much
easier. But of course you won't know it when your house smells like kitty litter.
True, but also you could pay somebody to live in your house and tell you when there's gas smell due to the massive lawsuit that you will wage against the makers of Zicam.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, that's right. I bought this product thinking there was nothing in it, and you put zinc in it.
Yeah, you told me there was nothing in this, and there was stuff in there.
That's why I think that I always shudder a little bit when skeptics do the sleeping pill suicide gag where, you know, you take the homeopathic sleeping aids and take as many as possible to commit suicide when in fact there's nothing in the pills. It always worries me a little bit because, geez, you know, they don't regulate them. Maybe they did throw something in there.
Yeah, you have to be careful.
You have to read the label.
You have to be very, very careful. So Zicam has a 1x dilution of one, you know, zinc ingredient and a 2x of another. So 2x is only a 1 to 100 dilution, and that still leaves a significant amount of zinc in there. So it's actually not homeopathic. It isn't homeopathic. It's,
no, it has actual active ingredients.
It has actual active ingredients in it. Yeah, absolutely, in a serious way. In case anyone out there doesn't know what homeopathy really is, it's diluting substances to the point where really no active ingredient remains.
Or molecules of the original of the
active ingredient. Not even a single molecule of the active ingredient is likely to be still remaining beyond just whatever's there in the water to begin with.
And that's if it's prepared correctly using homeopathic preparations.
There's really no correct homeopathic dilution. It's all made up stuff anyway, right? I mean, it's all stuff they just made up. I mean, one of the persons in the comment to my blog said they were asking a homeopath about this, or somebody involved with regulating homeopathy, like, what is a homeopathic dilution? And they said, well, how long is a piece of string, right? There's no answer to it. It's whatever they say
it is. So zen.
But most homeopathic dilutions are 12C or even 6C, whatever, 1 to 100, 10 times, 12 times, 20 times, 30 times. Those are, you get to dilutions where, you know, you're talking about, you need a volume the size of the solar system to have even a chance at having a single molecule left. Essentially, nothing is left. But 1X, 1 to 10, 1 to 100, you know, 2X, that's nothing. That's nothing.
Yeah. That's serious.
David Gorski, writing about the same topic, found some information that the Associated Press analysis of Food and Drug Administration side effect reports found more than 800 homeopathic ingredients were potentially implicated in health problems last year. So this is not an isolated incident. A lot of products marketed as homeopathic have drugs in them. They're cheating.
Yeah, that's right.
What do you think's going on there, Steve? Do you think this is a way for them to get around the otherwise stringent
requirements? I mean, Evan, they're using the allure of the word homeopathy and the fact that it's, you know, a natural, you know, natural healing of some kind or whatever, natural medicine. And then, of course, they're putting active ingredients in it. So it's best of both worlds. No regulation, so active ingredients, allure of all the bullshit woo, they got it all.
Yeah, I mean, they're marketing it as natural. There's nothing natural about homeopathy. It's just a marketing ploy. And most people don't know what homeopathy is. They don't know that it's utterly ridiculous. But it's not just that there. It's not just the marketing ploy, though. It's a regulatory loophole. In 1938, and this is the United States, in 1938, there was the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, which revised the rules for the FDA. And there was one senator, Senator Royal Copeland from New York, who was a homeopath and was a senator, essentially snuck in this exception for homeopathy, saying that homeopathic remedies that will be classified as drugs and regulated by the FDA. However, if they are any homeopathic agent listed in the homeopathic pharmacopoeia, the Materia Medica, or any of its supplements, right? Which means that at any time, the Homeopathic Pharmacopoeia Convention of the United States can write something down and say in a supplement and say this is now part of our list of homeopathic agents, and voila, it bypasses the FDA regulation. It gets automatic approval. It does not require any testing for safety or efficacy. It is a ginormous loophole in the regulation. That's exactly what happened with Zicam, and it's what happened with other products.
Well, who was sleeping at their post to let that through?
Bob, no one. These are the laws. Congress, you know, sets the laws. They decide what the FDA can and cannot do. This is exactly what happened. This is what Tom Harkin did in 1994 with herbal remedies
supplements.
And supplements. This guy, Royal Copeland, did in 1938 with homeopathic agents.
Well, you said he snuck it in. I was wondering, you know, how surreptitious was he?
Yeah, I don't know the nitty-gritty details about exactly what he did, but by the reports that I read, was that it was pretty sneaky the way he went about it. It wasn't like a big open debate. You know, you bury it in a massive bill and don't draw attention to it, and then, you know, nobody actually reads it.
Right.
So something like that is probably what went on.
Can't they just rescind it?
Yeah. Tomorrow, Congress could pass a law and, you know, update the FDA regulations and say, all right, we're no longer giving a pass to homeopathic remedies. Absolutely.
There has to be political will, though, Bob, to do so. That's yeah.
Maybe this will give them some. Maybe this will give them some will.
Yeah, we got to ride this wave. You know, I honestly think all of our listeners out there who live in the United States should write a letter or email to your senator or representative, you know, federal, and tell them that you're abhorred at the fact that the laws do not protect them against these drugs, that they're given a free pass and not tested even for safety, and that this ancient law, this 1938 law, needs to go away. It's an anti-consumer protection. We'll see what happens. We have to jump on items like this to make our voices known. Because believe it or not, the proponents, the people who have money to make from these, they make their voices known in politics and government.
Bastards.
Absolutely.
Well, maybe we have an update here from the government. Let's see what the latest they have to say about it is.
I've got a degree in homeopathic medicine.
You've got a degree in baloney.
There you go. That's the new official.
Oh, beautiful.
Official position.
Oh, and in better news, Futurama got picked up.
That's true.
Oh, sweet.
Yahoo! It'll be back in 2010. More Futurama. 10, 2000, right? 2010.
That show just will not die.
I'm so happy.
Not that I want to die.
But before we get off this topic entirely, the last point I was going to make is the FDA still has oversight over homeopathic remedies because they are quote-unquote drugs. And that's how they were able to get involved here. But basically, they can react to when a safety concern is raised. So because there were people reported to them, I've been injured by this product, possibly, the FDA can investigate and can issue warnings and they may even be able to pull it. So they're not powerless, but the burden, again, is on them to show that there's a safety concern here. There's no pre-marketing requirement for the company. Matrix Initiatives is the company who markets Zicam. They had no responsibility or no requirement to do any safety testing before they put it on the market.
Steve, how many people might have been impacted by this?
So 130 reports to the FDA. However, here's another interesting fact, is that the company itself apparently received about 800 reports of side effects from Zicam.
Oh, did nothing.
And they did nothing about it, and they did not report it to the FDA, which they are required to do. However, the FDA is not willing at this point to say that anybody broke any laws. They're just saying that they have asked the company to turn over all of their internal reports of side effects to Zicam. And in fact, I was emailing the FDA on this issue to make sure I had some facts straight, and I asked them about that, and they just were not willing to say that anybody broke any laws. So they're being very careful about that.
Man.
But you connect the dots. They're saying they had these internal reports. They didn't report them to the FDA. The laws that they're supposed to. The FDA is responding to patients and doctors who reported straight to them, not to the company.
Well, this could be a watershed event here, though, if the FDA does the right thing.
It's getting some press. It's always hard to say because I read so much science and skeptical blogs and stuff. I get a disproportionate attention to these kind of news items. I don't know if the average Joe in the street is hearing much about it.
That's true, but this does seem a little bit crazy, Steve. I mean, 800 people complaining beforehand, and now you've got 100 people potentially affected this way. Is there when's the last time something like this happened to this effect?
The last time this happened, Bob, was Ephedra. Ephedra was the supplement mainly used for weight loss. It's an amphetamine stimulant. And there about 100 people dropped dead. So dropping dead is a pretty serious side effect. And that was, again, about around the 100 level.
Cures you of all your symptoms.
Yeah, it does.
You'll never have another disease ever.
Except for worm rot.
And you'll have a severe case of rigor mortis followed by decomposition.
Not if you're Jay. He's going to be frozen.
That's true.
You might get frostbite.
That's true. That's right. Freezing is the ultimate cure of those diseases. One more news item. Our sunspots are missing.
Sunspots?
Hello.
But astronomers think they may have found them.
Yay.
There's a sunspot thief amongst us.
We've talked about this in the past. I think we talked about it at the end of last year that for a while now, the sun has been in some bizarre state. For the past year or two, sunspots have been very few and far between for quite a while. Now, I don't know about you guys. When I hear the sun's doing something odd, I get a little bit nervous. Don't you feel that way sometimes?
That's pretty big.
No, I don't because I think the sun is ridiculously stable. I mean,
well, I know, but something like this,
that's what
know,
it wants
it's not
to
like
think.
I need meds for my anxiety. It's just like every now and then I think, oh man, I hope this doesn't turn into something really weird, you know, because there's still so much we don't know about the sun and the potential quirks of stellar evolution. You know, maybe the sun's getting ready to create one massive sunspot that's going to blow out a coronal mass ejection that's going to just fry the Earth or something crazy. I don't know.
Will it be nocturnal?
So I was relieved, obviously, to hear recently that NASA thinks they've finally figured this thing out and figured out what's going on. Sunspots, we all know what sunspots are. They're Earth-sized magnetic islands on the surface of the sun. They appear black only because they're a little bit cooler than the surrounding. And these sunspots can produce solar flares and coronal mass ejections and intense UV radiation. Now, the solar activity follows a 22-year cycle. Every 11 years, it builds to a peak of sunspot production. And then halfway through the next 11-year cycle, it's going down into a solar minimum where there's very, very few sunspots produced. And that's where we are right now. We're in this solar minimum. That's a real crazy, amazing minimum. It's really almost unprecedented.
It's the biggest minimum in 100 years, right?
Yeah, but since 1913. And just to go over what we're seeing here, 2008 saw 266 spotless days, which is the worst since 1913. And 2009 is not doing much better. We've actually made a bunch of records, 50-year low in solar wind pressure, 12-year low in solar irradiance, 55-year low in solar radio emissions. So it's pretty weird. So what does all this mean? Is this just an extreme thing, or is it some sort of correction? Because the past few solar maxima we've had have been fairly intense, so maybe it's just some kind of correction. But the big elephant in the room, I think, that I don't see too many people talking about is, have you guys heard about the Maunder minimum in 1645 to 1715? It was like it is now. Very few sunspots. In fact, some years there were like no sunspots at all. So it was pretty crazy. And this minimum just happened to coincide with the extreme cold spells in Europe. They called it the Little Ice Age. So it's, I mean, that's an oversimplification. Obviously, there were other factors. But either Google Maunder minimum or go to our show notes if you want some more details. But maybe we're entering another minimum like that. Imagine 100 years like this and many ice ages sprouting all over the place. Well, the good news is that probably not. It doesn't look like this is what's happening now because of Rachel Howe and Frank Hill, the National Solar Observatory. They're using a technique called helioseismology that basically listens to the surface of the sun like a bell ringing. All these pressure waves that are in the sun kind of make – you know, disturb the surface of the sun, and they can read the surface of the sun like a bell vibrating to find out what's going on the inside. And they've been tracking a jet stream. I didn't know this. There's a jet stream of sorts inside the sun, about 7,000 kilometers in the surface, that's created at the poles, and then it migrates to the equator. And when it gets really close to the equator, relatively close to the equator, it kicks off a new sunspot cycle. And they've been tracking this thing using helioseismology, and they found out that this jet stream has been kind of sluggish. It's been moving not as slow as it usually does. When it finally reached that critical location towards the equator, that's when sunspots kind of started appearing again. So it seems that now that this jet stream has reached the proper place, that we're going to really start seeing sunspots start appearing again. And then we'll just be back on our way to the solar maximum coming up in whatever, 2012 or 13 or whatever, whenever it appears. So that's good news in my book.
Word.
But they're thinking the sunspots may be coming back, but I guess we don't know. You know, yeah, a couple appeared recently. Is this going to be a trend? Are we coming out of our minimum? Or is it just a couple more sunspots, but not
right.
really a trend?
Right. If we don't see many more sunspots, and that would kind of blow their theory out the water. But it really seems like they're extremely confident because when this jet stream hit that critical separation from the equator, that's when like the first sunspots really started appearing. So either that was a coincidence or there's really something to it. So time will tell. If we don't get much for the rest of this year, then I don't know what they're going to think.
Right.
So I'm reading this blog here. some Rogue Gallery back in January 5th of this year. And it seems like one of us made a bunch of predictions as to what was going to happen in 2009. Let me just skim down here and look at one. Solar activity will continue to be low for the first half of the year and then regain activity in the second half.
Who said that?
Who predicted that in writing on their blog? Oh, wait. It was
What are the chances?
No.
What were the odds of that?
A million bucks. A million to one.
You got it, man.
I specifically made predictions that I knew no other psychic or astrologer or anyone else would make, and that was one.
Awesome. Well done, Evan.
Thanks. A little feather in the cap right there.
Was that the sound of a feather being inserted in a cap?
Of course.
I could have done this, too.
No. That would be taking out the feather.
How about this?
I don't know what that is. That was...
No. Who's that noisy, Evan? Yeah. Oh, sorry, wrong part of the show. All right. Well, I think actually that it's time for our interview. So let's go on with that. Joining us now is Dr. Richard Prum. Richard, welcome to the Skeptic's Guide.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Richard is a researcher in the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at Yale, so he's one of my colleagues, and he's also the William Robertson Co-Professor of Ornithology, Ecology, and Evolutionary Biology at the Peabody Museum of Natural History. So you're a bird guy.
I am a bird guy. I am really interested in bird diversity, avian evolution, from lots of different perspectives, particularly feathers. I'm a real fan of feathers and feather evolution.
Okay, well, our listeners will try not to hold that against you.
Okay.
So we got you on the show because there's a news item out this week that, you know, both Bob and I had the same reaction to this news item, that it was just outrageous, you know, the way it was being reported. And I told you briefly about, you know, which one caught my attention. This is a recent discovery about the evolution of bird lungs and how birds breathe and keep their lungs from collapsing. And what we found outrageous about the article, that it was trying to make the point that this to read you the headline, "Discovery Raises New Doubts About Dinosaur Bird Lynx." And this crops up every now and then. So tell us what you think about the scientific evidence and the status of the hypothesis that birds evolved from theropod dinosaurs. How certain are we of that?
Well, interestingly, there's a long debate in this area. So for most of the 20th century, the favorite hypothesis was that birds and dinosaurs and crocodiles were all closely related within a group of reptiles called archosaurs. But that trying to figure out who birds were related to within that group of archosaurs was difficult to establish. This hypothesis goes back to about the 1920s. And basically what it was is a statement that we can do no better than this vague notion that birds emerged early on in archosaur history. Then going up to about the late 60s, early 70s, there was a guy named John Ostrom. He was a professor of geology at Yale, and he described one of the first well-known raptor dinosaurs. It was called Deinonychus, and this was before Velociraptor was well-known, et cetera. And he described the anatomy of this creature, and it's a theropod dinosaur. It's way up in the lineage of bipedal meat-eating dinosaurs. And he concluded in the late 60s, early 70s, based on the details of the wrists and the bipedal gait and a lot of other details, that birds were related to Deinonychus, in particular that birds were a lineage of theropod dinosaurs. This started a decades-long debate between the traditionalists who argued that we should not, we don't know what birds are, and a series of guys who were supporting the theropod dinosaur hypothesis. You'd have to say that over the last 20 years, a whole series of discoveries have completely reinforced the idea that, or the scientific evidence, that birds are a lineage of theropod dinosaurs. In particular, it's been recently discovered that many of these theropod dinosaurs had feathers, that feathers did not evolve uniquely within the lineage we know of as birds, but earlier, prior to the origin of birds and prior to the evolution of flight, in theropod dinosaurs. So there's now basically an overwhelming amount of evidence, such that it's very difficult difficult now to distinguish many of the earliest birds from very closely related theropod dinosaurs that we would never have considered birds before.
Yeah, isn't it true that one of the early specimens of Archaeopteryx was mistaken for years as a Compsognathus skeleton?
Absolutely.
Until someone noticed the feather impressions?
And the idea that we don't know about, or that we couldn't know about the ancestry of birds goes to, dates from a book by a guy named Heilman in the 1920s. And Heilman concluded that birds could be congeneric with, or Archaeopteryx could be congeneric with Compsognathus. That is, they could be in the same genus, except for a few telling details. In particular, that Compsognathus lacked a furcula. The furcula is the wishbone in birds, and it's found in Archaeopteryx, and it's formed by the fusion of the clavicle bones. And Heilman concluded that since Compsognathus didn't have the clavicles, did not have a furcula, that birds could not be descended from dinosaurs, in particular because he was a fan of an outmoded notion called Dolo's Law, which is once we lost a structure, we couldn't regain it. We now have ample evidence that all sorts of theropod dinosaurs had a furcula. So, for example, Velociraptor and Deinonychus and all the raptors, even Tyrannosaurus rex has been found to have a furcula. So the exact data that Heilman used to reject the dinosaur theropod origin of birds has now been overcome. If Heilman were alive today, he'd be a complete fan of the theropod origin. Unfortunately, there are still a few modern descendants of Heilman who try to defend his ideas.
Before we get to them, and we will, so what you're saying is that there are anatomical features in theropods which are similar enough to features in early birds and later birds that ties those two groups together. But also, we now have this growing number of feathered dinosaurs, of theropod dinosaurs with feathers, showing that feathers arose in that group, one branch of which led to birds, and that's a pretty solid conclusion.
Yes, the issue is not just that there are similarities. What's really happened along the way is that there have been a host of derived or special similarities, similarities that show exclusive common ancestry between specific groups of theropod dinosaurs and birds. So you can go from the tip to the tail, from the nose, from the head, all the way to the tail, through both limb bones, all the limb bones, and identify lots of features throughout the body that are shared and derived, that is, they're evolutionary novelties that occur in some dinosaurs and in birds. So as a result, you get this beautiful hierarchical distribution of traits that reconstruct the entire tree. There's very, very little evidence to the contrary.
So it's not just feathers. The feathers are just the most dramatic example of a shared derived.
Yeah, the feathers are the most dramatic. What's fascinating about them is that by finding out that feathers evolved in dinosaurs before the origin of birds, we essentially lose our most potent ability to define what a bird is. People have gotten confused. What are birds now that there's a lot of feathered things out there that we wouldn't call birds? In addition, finding out that things like Velociraptor, which chased the kids in the kitchen around in Jurassic Park, to imagine that that organism was actually fully plumaged like a modern bird really transforms our concept of what dinosaurs were like. And so as a consequence, that's the most compelling and fascinating evidence.
Given all these similarities, it's even more surprising then to me that the two articles that I read about this new research, how can they just ignore all these other similarities that you've mentioned?
Well, one of the interesting things is that there's been a large change in the scientific methods throughout the same period from the 1970s until today, right? And what we really have is a clash between older methods and modern methods, right? And in the old days, basically, it was concluded that classification, especially higher-level classification, was a result of, sort of authorities spending all their lives studying great details of organisms and coming up with an opinion about their relationships. And essentially, classification was a filing system. It was not an attempt to actually discover the true historical facts of the descendants or the ancestry of life. People are shocked to understand this, but in fact, the attempt to turn modern classification into a discovery process where we're trying to actually discover the tree of life, is a rather modern scientific goal, dating from really only the last few decades. So the guys who are denying or criticizing the theropod origin of birds are really arguing about the methods that are used to reconstruct the tree. And what's interesting is that they provide no alternative scientific hypothesis. So in this most recent work by Rubin from Oregon State, they criticize the theropod origin of birds, but they don't provide an alternative hypothesis, right? What that means is that they're still supporting the vague, non-alternative, inexplicit alternative, actually untestable alternative provided by Heilman in the 1920s, that avian ancestry is unknowable and goes back to some vague point earlier on in history in this archosaurian group. So this is really not science. Over the years, I've been frustrated with this point of view. Some years ago, I wrote a piece called Why Ornithologists Should Care About the Theropod Origin of Birds, where I address these issues. And in preparation for that piece, I discovered a fantastic quote by Thomas Kuhn from The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. And Kuhn was trying to define science in a modern and also cultural context. How does science progress? How are hypotheses tested by groups of real flesh and blood people arguing over ideas? And in that, he has this fantastic quote where he says, "The man who rejects one hypothesis without simultaneously proposing an alternative is rejecting science itself."
Oh.
The quote goes on, "He will be known to his colleagues as the carpenter who blames his tools." And this was just perfect, because what these guys do are blaming the tools. They're saying our methods to reconstruct the history of life are insufficient and birds cannot be related to theropod dinosaurs, but they present no scientifically testable alternative hypothesis.
And just to put to bed this particular new study by Rubin, what they're pointing at is that the thigh bone in birds is fixed, and it's fixed in place in order to support the air sacs, and that it's not fixed in dinosaurs. But can't that just be a derived characteristic of birds?
Well, the study is weak in numerous ways. One, there's almost no sample of actual dinosaurs in the paper. They compare living birds to Allosaurus, which is quite far out the tree and also is a huge dinosaur. There are numerous maniraptorans or raptor dinosaurs that are very similar to basal birds that aren't analyzed here. So we get no conclusion about actually what the position of the femur is during locomotion or the thigh bone during locomotion in theropod dinosaurs. But you're exactly correct. What they merely do in the study is to present evidence that birds are birds. That is, that birds have derived features that are unique to
right.
a group
yeah.
of birds. That says nothing about the ancestry of birds, and they contribute nothing to any description of the origin of the novelties in avian breeding that they propose to be interested in. So really, there's besides just additionally putting one more rather tiny functional notch on the tree leading to bird and saying, hey, that's where that happened, they contribute no conclusion as to how that evolved. This would be the equivalent of saying, wow, you know, humans speak, and, you know, none of the other apes do. And so they possibly be related to apes. And frankly, this is the same kind of logic that creationists use.
Exactly.
And I'm sorry to say that this type of research is very vulnerable to abuse by people who are arguing that evolutionary biology does not provide an explanation of the origin of biodiversity.
Rubin also makes one other point that that casual readers might find to be a slam dunk. If you could explain this one thing. He says, for one thing, birds are found earlier in the fossil record than the dinosaurs they are supposed to have descended from. That's a pretty serious problem, and there are other inconsistencies with the bird from dinosaur theories. Clearly, he's wrong, I guess, but why? How could you explain, you know, why that's not the case?
There's another great example. You know, primitively, people originally tried to read the stratigraphic record as an actual linear history of life, right? But the history of life, the relationships among organisms, has the shape of a tree, right? As things branch off from one another, the tree of life gets increasingly more and more complicated, right? So what we're really trying to do is reconstruct the tree of life. You know, what the lineage, the branch that gives rise to birds, what other branches is it related to? What Ruben is talking about is a much older and, you'd have to say, outmoded and inappropriate way of thinking, which is that the fossil record is actually going to give us a linear series over time, like a scala naturae, if you will, of structures, right? There's lots of example where groups that we know are primitive are actually not represented in the fossil record as well. So, for example, if you look at the fossil record for mammals, right, the three main mammal groups include placental mammals, ourselves, marsupial mammals, and then monotremes that lay eggs. The fossil record for monotremes, for egg-laying mammals, goes back only a few million years. But the fossil record for placentals now goes back to something like 90 million years. And so as a consequence, if you followed Ruben's logic, you'd say that egg-laying mammals evolved from placental mammals. That's absurd. The fact is that we use the characters that these fossils and these living organisms share and do not share in order to reconstruct the tree. And the fossil, the linear series, the stratigraphic record, does not give us a complete or perfect view of the interrelationships in organisms. Having said that, recent discoveries have made the gap that that Ruben is pointing to much smaller. Back for most of the 70s, 80s, and 90s, the gap between the earliest bird fossil, Archaeopteryx, at about 145 million years, and the Maniraptoran fossils, the theropod dinosaurs, was huge. The theropod dinosaurs didn't show up until, almost 80 million years ago, right? So you had a very, very large gap. Recent discoveries from the Liaoning in China, an early Cretaceous location that's about 125, 130 million years old, show a great diversity of raptor dinosaurs, shrinking this apparent gap down to just a few tens of millions of years. So they've really destroyed that argument, and Ruben is really being disingenuous to cite it as a big problem, because it's not a problem.
Yeah, it's the spottiness of the fossil record. You have groups branch off and persist, and then we're looking at later examples of that branch, even though it still retains some so-called primitive characteristics from the branching point.
Right, right. And I mean, just the fact that bacteria are still alive, but, you know, some species of giant sloths are extinct doesn't mean that bacteria evolved from giant sloths. You know, you could pick any tree of life and find such anomalies, and they do not falsify our reconstruction of the branches.
Now, recently in the news, there was an apparent fossil dinosaur from another branch other than the theropods that they said may have had feathers. Do you remember that?
Yes, yes. Very interesting work from, again, from a different location in China.
So wouldn't that imply that feathers go back farther than theropods and, in fact, to a much earlier branching point of dinosaurs?
This is interesting stuff, and obviously this is much closer to the research I've been doing, though I have not seen this specimen in particular. What's interesting about this dinosaur, which turns out to be a basal member of the large vegetarian group of dinosaurs called Ornithischians, right? So this includes an earlier branch in the group that it would include Stegosaurus and Triceratops and Iguanodon and all those guys, right? And the fossil shows these large fuzzy filaments coming out of the skin. So clearly it's got something growing out of the skin. The question is it feathers or not? It's my opinion that the work made that claim without really enough evidence. And interestingly, there's lots of samples of dinosaurs that are between birds and this creature, which we know do not have feathers. So, for example, there's beautifully preserved sauropod skin, the long-necked dinosaurs like Apatosaurus and all those guys, beautiful pebbly football-style pig skin, you know,
yeah.
Rounded scales. We know those guys didn't have stuff grown out of their skin. Is this stuff feathers? It's my opinion that it's probably not. We know that the skin of archosaurs has the capacity to grow or to evolve all sorts of interesting stuff on it. And I think given the gap between these other ornithischian filaments that are found on these other dinosaurs and what we know of as the filamentous structures within theropods and birds, it's my opinion that these guys are convergently evolved filament and not feathers. But honestly, right. It'd be exciting to get more research, more samples, look at their anatomy in more detail and see if we could test that idea.
Let's talk about Dr. Alan Fiducia from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He has been probably one of the most outspoken opponents of the bird from dinosaur hypothesis in recent decades.
He sure has.
And you've actually gone toe-to-toe with him. Why don't you tell us about that?
You know, there have been a lot of attempts to try to respond to Fiducia and others who have been critical of the theropod origin. And one thing you have to say is a lot of those responses ended up strengthening the argument. The science supporting the theropod origin has improved. So I guess they, in some sense, provided an important function. But starting about 2001, I had sat on the sidelines mostly, but I decided finally to write this piece on why ornithologists should care about the theropod origin. And basically, I was addressing my own colleagues, people who work on living birds, who really didn't care what birds were related to. They thought, oh, paleontologists should care, and they're getting into all these arguments about it, but. I don't really need to know. I work on, you know, clutch size, or I work on migration, or I work on song. And I don't need to know about dinosaurs. That's a silly idea. So I decided that I would write this piece, and I reviewed the evidence in favor of the theropod origin, and I dealt with the critiques like ideas about from Alan. And then I sort of tried to point out how everything we know about avian biology is really has the potential to be informed by the theropod origin. That really dinosaurs should be in every single chapter in the ornithology textbook, right? And I started to come up or point out these, you know, exciting examples of this. And, of course, Alan came down really hard in a critique on that, trying to overturn it. What was interesting is just as he was going to press, he was faced with new evidence that actually maniraptorine dinosaurs, things like Velociraptor and Deinonychus actually were fully feathered. So he had this real problem. And the real problem was that, obviously, if these things had beautiful feathers on them, it contradicted a whole 20 years of his research. And indeed, this is absolutely demonstrated fact now, that the dromaeosaurs were feathered. How could he deal with that fact, having argued relentlessly that these things were theropod dinosaurs, unrelated to birds and completely convergent with birds? Well, he did an absolutely about-face. He said that these things are actually not dinosaurs, but birds, and that birds are still unrelated to theropod dinosaurs, in complete contradiction to a massive amount of his own work. So this was too much. And so finally I came down pretty heavy on him, and I wrote a piece entitled Our Modern Critiques of the Theropod Origin of Birds, Science. And I concluded that these guys are not doing science. You know, I think that was until Rubin's article, that was the last peer-reviewed scientific paper that questioned the theropod origin of birds, was Fiducia's critique of my paper. There are people who have questioned the homology of the feathers, but they have not been able to get into a peer-reviewed journal. I think the journal Morphology that published this paper by Rubin has unfortunately not asked for that standard. So Alan and I have gone toe-to-toe over the years. He's been pretty quiet in the recent times. And I don't know, maybe he's running out of energy, but maybe this will bring him back.
Can you tell us very quickly about some of your recent research? I noticed that about a year ago you published a paper where your team discovered how to tell what color fossilized feathers were.
Right. So that was fascinating stuff where we, going back to the first time that people looked at fossil feathers with an electron microscope in about 1975, 1980, people had identified that when you see a fossil feather, what you're seeing is the bacteria that ate the feather, or that was ate the feather protein at the time it was dissolving or rotting in the sediment. And this hypothesis had been repeated, unquestioned for decades. What we discovered is that those objects that people were looking at were not bacteria; they were melanosomes. They are which are the little organelles that include or that contain melanin, the pigment that makes prominent black and reddish brown colors in basically all of multicellular animals. So these melanosomes actually fossilize in these feathers. And the protein that surrounds them, the keratin of the feather, dissolves, but the melanin granules remain. So we were able to show this by looking at a fossil feather that shows a striped color pattern, black and white and black and white. And sure enough, in the black parts, we have these melanosomes. In the white parts, you know, we just have pure impressions of the filaments of the feather, no actual melanosomes. Mm. We've been continuing that research up through even the last week, and we're avidly pursuing how we can reconstruct the coloration patterns in fossil feathers.
But does it tell you, like, red versus blue, or are you just where there was color and where there was less color?
Well, that's the subject of the research we're doing right now. Interestingly, I'll spill the beans. I'm sure there are competitors out there, but let's go to it. It turns out that pheomelanin is the red-brown melanin. Mm-hmm. It's the same melanin that's responsible for human red hair and freckles and stuff. And eumelanin is the black melanin that's responsible for black hair and black feathers. So in birds, the eumelanosomes, the melanosomes that contain melanin, are ovoid. They're sort of longer in one dimension and round in the other dimension. So they look like a little pill or a tic-tac. But the pheomelanosomes that are red-brown are actually closer to spherical, a little bit off of spherical, egg-shaped. So we should we find them, we should be able to distinguish between fossil red-brown and fossil black. Black feathers, black hair, and red-brown feathers or red-brown hair. And that will be interesting when we find them.
Yeah, awesome. One quick question. Do you have an opinion about the ivory-billed woodpecker?
Sure. I was one of the early critics of the ivory-billed woodpecker. I don't know if you remember that or followed that at all, but I was the first guy essentially to call it unlikely. Even the fact that our manuscript, which we were preparing at that time, the fact that it existed was enough to put us on the front page of the New York Times.
Yeah.
The rumor that we were going to be critiquing it. We ended up blinking and withdrawing our paper, but in fact, you know, there has been no substantial evidence to support either the original Science article or to substantiate later claims that the ivory-billed woodpecker is alive in the United States. So, depressingly for me and for the others, I think we have to reconsider and conclude that, you know, there isn't really any evidence that the ivory-billed woodpecker is alive.
You think those fuzzy pictures are pileated woodpeckers?
The movie is 100% consistent with a normal pileated woodpecker in flight.
Okay.
There's no reason to imagine that it was an aberrant or unusual individual.
But there again, we have a minority opinion. But that's okay. Here, I agree with you, but if we get evidence, hard evidence of an ivory-billed woodpecker, I'll happily believe it.
I agree as well. And what was interesting is that at the time, there were lots of people that were critical of that ivory-billed woodpecker claim, but they were afraid to say what they thought. So that was one of the reasons why I stepped forward, because I figured, hey, I got nothing to lose here. I don't work on conservation biology. I don't even work on woodpeckers. but I can identify birds, and this is why there's some weakness there, or why there was a critical weaknesses in the argument.
Well, Richard, thank you so much for speaking
with
us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to talk to you guys. When I first got your email, I was a little concerned that you might be eager to propagate the he said, she said quality of the story, and it's a really fun to talk about the story and from this perspective.
Well, good. I'm glad you enjoyed the conversation.
Well, thanks very much, and keep up the good work.
Good talking.
Good night.
Good
take
good
care.
Night.
Bye.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Of course, this week, I had to come up with six science news items because I have recorded two shows this week. Not an easy task.
I am ready. Let's do this.
This week, we have a theme. Because I know how you love themes.
Why does theme? I love themes.
The theme is evolution.
Yeah.
I know her, Eve. Evolution. Got
here,
it.
Here we go. Item number one. A new morphological analysis of modern and fossil apes suggests that humans are most closely related to orangutans and form a separate group from chimpanzees and gorillas. Item number two, scientists have developed a new computer program that can automate the process of analyzing DNA to create phylogenies, a picture of the evolutionary tree of life, that is much faster and more accurate than existing methods. Item number three, biologists have discovered a new species of water snake, the only one known to have evolved the technique of capturing prey by first hypnotizing it with its rhythmic undulating motion. Jay, you go first.
Right. Okay, first item, a new morphological analysis of modern and fossil apes suggests that humans are most closely related to orangutans and form a separate group from chimpanzees and gorillas. Okay, I'll move on to the second one. Scientists have developed a new computer program that can automate the process of analyzing DNA to create phylogenies.
Phylogenies.
Exactly. A picture of the evolutionary tree of life that is much faster, more accurate than existing methods. I mean, I completely believe that. And the third one, biologists have discovered a new species of water snake, the only one known to have evolved the technique of capturing prey by first hypnotizing it with a rhythmic undulating emotion. That one is the fake.
Okay, Evan?
Well, this morphological analysis of modern and fossil apes, I do think that this one is science, and I'm going to call up my knowledge of the movie Planet of the Apes and use that as my reference. They were very...
Which one did he make out with? Wasn't that a chimpy kind of one?
Was she a chimpanzee? Yeah, she
was.
The gorillas were the enforcers, and the chimps were the scientists,
right.
And the orangutans were the
philosophers,
leaders, right?
The politicians.
Yeah, the politicians.
See, so he was mating with a chimp, which means that we'd be closer to chimps.
And here's a little kick. Rod Serling, actually, I believe, was the executive producer or one of the producers of that movie. So there's a Twilight Zone
connection.
Aspect to all of this.
I'm glad we worked all that out.
Oh, yeah. Well,
Wait, so what are we doing?
I think that one is science. And then the second one, regarding the phylogenies, you can all chuckle.
Phylogenies.
Yes.
Thank you.
It was funny when Jay did it.
he was my favorite Egyptian god. Yes, I think that one is also science. So it looks like I'm going to agree with Jay about this hypnotizing snake, although I was a little suspect on that one. Well, maybe not suspect, but I was maybe leaning towards thinking that one was science because I think the cobra video footage I've seen, you know, how the snake charmers in India deal with the cobra, and it does have this, you know, rhythm that they go through side to side.
No, it doesn't.
And it could be hypnotizing, but I think I'm not sure I'm remembering that correctly or understanding it correctly, so I'll go with that as the fiction.
Alrighty, Bob?
The first one, the morphological analysis of orangutans, that's quite a conclusion because, God, for years it's been we're closer to chimps because of the analysis of the DNA, but so this is a different take on it. So I guess it's feasible that they could have found lots of morphological similarities between humans and orangutans. But could that trump the DNA similarities? I would think no, but it's just a really interesting idea. And the computer program, yeah, that one really seems like a no-brainer, maybe too much of a no-brainer. So I'd like to pick that one because it's just so too obvious. But I think I'm going to go with three. The water snake hypnotizing, that seems out of whack. I'm going to say that one is fiction.
Okay, Rebecca?
Yeah.
Those TPS files, yeah.
Yeah, I'm gonna need those TPS files on the cover sheet. Here's my issue. It's with the third item. The water snake that hypnotizes its prey. Clearly, hypnotizing is in quotes, right? So my question is, what do you mean by that? Because I don't think it's like the snake is lulling any fish, you know, to sleep and then gobbling them up. I think this question is very misleading, and honestly, I could go either way.
The word hypnotizing is in quotes, you know, because, you know, it's as much of an analogy to what we would think of as hypnosis as you can have with a snake and a fish, right? But the key there is that it's using its rhythmic undulating motion in order to change the behavior of the fish so that it just sort of floats there and then it makes easy pickings.
Yeah, that's how I interpret it.
Right, that's how I assumed everyone was going to interpret it.
Yeah.
Because of that, I'm going to go with the group and say that that's false because that's not what happens. The fish doesn't just sit there.
Yeah. All right.
Okay.
Of course not.
So, yeah.
Okay.
So you all agree that the snake is not hypnotizing fish with its undulating motion. So let's take these in order. Number one, a new morphological analysis of modern and fossil apes suggests that humans are most closely related to orangutans and form a separate group from chimpanzees and gorillas. You all think this one is science, and this one is science.
How cool is that? That is awesome.
That's
I didn't see that.
Cool.
I never would have believed that.
Yeah, I have to say, even though I use this as a science item, I don't buy it. But this team did, in fact, publish this study. That's why I said suggest. Is obviously doesn't prove it. It doesn't. This
right.
is not changing the consensus of opinion on this topic. My sense is that this is probably a minority opinion. However, they published a study. These guys, Schwartz and Grahan, looking at a lot of different morphological traits of living and extinct, you know, fossil apes, and they concluded that apes and orangutans share more unique features in common than the other apes, and that the only traits that humans share in common with chimpanzees are ones that are common to all apes,
right.
but not ones that are unique to each other.
Yeah, we're talking a lot of similarities here, Steve.
Yeah.
We're talking like 26 similarities between humans and orangutans, and between chimpanzees and humans, it was like, what, 3 or 4?
8.
Probably 8.
It was 8.
Like Bob, it sounds like times. You knew about this item before you were asked.
Oh, this is fascinating. I was like, I was shy. I knew he was going to use this one. It was just too cool not to use.
Yeah. So it does bring up an interesting issue of how we know what evolved from what into what when. You know, how do we draw the lines of the so-called tree of life? And there are different ways that you can do this. You know, the traditional method is through morphological analysis. The more modern method is through DNA analysis. Frankly, I think the DNA analysis trumps the morphological analysis.
Exactly. That's my thoughts.
Yeah. And I think that that's probably the consensus opinion. However, you know, maybe consensus is too strong a word. I think there are two schools of thought out there. There are the traditionalists who favor morphology and then the more modern geneticists who favor DNA analysis. I think the winds of change, though, are blowing in favor of the DNA analysis. That's just my opinion. I know there's probably people out there who have a different opinion. And it does, I think, shake out in terms of whether or not you're a paleontologist or a geneticist. So you're biased by your training as to what kind of evidence. And that's typical. I find that a lot, too. The evidence that you're most familiar with, that you know how to interpret, is what you find most compelling. But looking in on this issue as an outsider, I personally find the DNA analysis more compelling. But again, this is not in any way my expertise.
But Steve, can the DNA analysis kind of explain away the morphological similarities and vice versa?
I'm actually not sure how to answer that, Bob. But I think the thing to keep in mind is that all of these species are related to each other and very closely related to each other, right? We're not talking about, you know, are we more related to
yeast
a horse?
People.
Yeah, you know, a horse or a chimpanzee. Talking, you know, gorillas, chimps, orangs, and humans, all very closely related. Our common ancestors are going back somewhere between 8 and 15 million years. The question is, those branch points 8 to 10 million years or so ago, what branched first? And this actually plays into the next item, number 2. Scientists have developed a new computer program that can automate the process of analyzing DNA to create phylogenies, a picture of the evolutionary tree of life that is much faster and more accurate than existing models, and that one is also science.
Mm. Yeah.
Yay.
That was kind of the obvious one, but it's obvious and true, but I wanted to use it because it's cool. So these were, you know, again, scientists and computer programmers that are automating a process. I mean, it's obvious, right, to use computers, crunching information to do this kind of analysis, but up until this point,
they couldn't do it?
Geneticists were doing it, quote unquote, by hand or manually.
Oh, man.
When they were comparing different DNA sequences for genes in different species, you have to line up the different DNA sequences. They call it an alignment. You have to create an alignment. And there's some, you know, subjectivity there.
It's more art.
Yeah, it's a little bit of art.
Art,
you know, it's not 100% science because you're guessing a little bit about what lines up with what. So What the computer program does is it can analyze multiple alternate ways of aligning different protein or DNA sequences, and you get more of a consensus sort of alignment, a much quicker and much more accurate alignment. You know, that's the thinking, and that's what the researchers are proposing in their science article that they wrote. And they did compare it with existing alignments or these phylogenetic analyses, and it matched. So that said, okay, it works at least as well as what we have out there now. And so I think that this could really revolutionize the drawing of the tree of life. It's computer, you know, powered now. So now we're on Moore's law is going to be in effect for the speed of this. They're going to get better at the software. So we're going to be able to much more accurately draw a DNA-derived tree of life, and I think this will give us this will reduce our error bars, and we'll get much more accurate pictures.
But still we need to lay out the genome for these animals first.
Yeah.
So and that process is continuing, but that's probably the bottleneck. It's not like they can automate the whole damn tree overnight. We still probably need thousands of genomes to be laid out before it could really flesh out this tree or bush.
The more genomes we sequence, the more data they could feed into this kind of program, the more accurate a tree of life we'll be able to draw. But we may be at the point where in 10 or 20 years, we'll have a remarkably detailed and accurate tree of life just by analyzing living species. Forget about even looking at fossils of extinct species.
I'm sure there's going to be lots of surprises along the way. I can't wait to see.
Yes.
Some of the first ones like, oh, wow, this guy's related to this guy. Oh, wow, check that out.
And, of course, every time that happens, the buffoons at the Discovery Institute will jump all over it and say, see, it doesn't line up. Duh. But it's because of, again, it's just the error bars in the data, right? That's what they – of course, they don't precisely line up because it's you know, there's only so much precision to this kind of analysis. But the broad brushstrokes are absolutely clear. Yeah, we're quibbling about – you know, chimpanzees or orangs being our closest ancestor. But if we were created, we could be, you know, genetically more closely related to bears, you know, or petunias. You know, it wouldn't have to be chimpanzees or orangs, you know.
Yeah, if we were closer to yeast, then they might have an argument.
Sure. All of this means that biologists have discovered a new species of water snake, the only one known to have evolved the technique of capturing prey by first hypnotizing it with its rhythmic undulating motion, is completely and totally fiction.
That's right.
Yeah, you bastardized a real
story. There are no water snakes.
Yeah, it's not complete fiction. This is a problem I had because there is a snake that does trick fish, and I've seen it called hypnotizing.
Really?
No, I didn't see that anywhere.
Hypnotize used. Yeah. And so that's why I wanted to make absolutely sure what you meant.
All right.
By
I'm glad to clarify that I did not see the word hypnotizing used in any of the news stories I read about this. So I obviously would not have done that. And it doesn't use its undulating motion. I totally made that part up too. What it does is it startles the fish into swimming into its mouth.
Nice move.
Right? So that's
sweet.
Part of it is that it doesn't track the fish itself. It sort of it estimates where the fish is going to be. And then based upon that, it maneuvers it or tricks it into swimming into its mouth. Right.
Pretty cool.
So I thought that was different enough from hypnotizing it with its undulating motion that it would be fiction. But I didn't see the word hypnotizing used.
Yeah.
All right. So basically, you've totally flammed it this week, Steve, because it was very easy.
Yeah, you know.
Well,
as I said, two in a week.
I don't know. I don't know, Jay.
One and three were.
Jay, why didn't you pick one, Jay? Because that one, if I didn't read that, I don't know. I would have really.
One would have
been.
If you hadn't read it, one would have been very tough. If you were familiar
if you followed
with the
that
DNA
stuff,
evidence for.
I'm just saying.
Jim's being related to you. Well, Evan.
Okay, here we go. Last week's noisy.
Many memorandums were drawn up as to a general system that would permit of the subdivision of the light into small units analogous to gaseous and with commercial economy superior to the prevailing gas system.
And that was the voice of Thomas Alva Edison.
Thomas Edison. Yeah, kind of sounded like Tom.
I've heard him. I called that one.
I mean, I frankly, before I went researching him, I didn't know what he sounded like. I didn't even know there was that much recording of him to be found. But there are a few pieces out there, and that was one of them. It was a little difficult because it was grainy, you know, staticky.
Yeah.
Well, that's what kind of keyed me into Edison, though, is that it was clearly very old. And since he invented, the sound recording technology, I figured there had to be some examples of him talking. Just a quick aside, you guys know that sound recording was one of those very, very few new technologies that when it was developed, nobody saw it coming at all. Can you imagine at that time, nobody was even predicting or talking about even the possibility of recording sound and playing it back later?
Yeah, that's interesting.
Nobody saw it coming.
That's very hard to
imagine. Yeah.
And the first person to get this one right was Trinach from the board. So congratulations, Trinach.
Now, for the moment we've all been waiting for.
Yes.
You've sat through an hour to get to this point.
I'm so excited.
It is exciting. This week's Who's That Noisy?
Yeah, I'm sort of like, I guess, Bob Dylan was when somebody said, why don't you sing other people's songs? And he said, well, he sort of come to that point where people expected him to sing his own. I guess I've done enough investigations now that I'm expected to talk about mine rather than Phil Klass's or somebody whose investigations I would probably garble and mess up.
There you go. Now,
Evan,
I know you guys know who that is.
Evan, you broke your pattern.
Yeah. Person.
Is that okay?
I'm just saying.
It's a holiday.
I'm just saying.
So,
what does that mean?
It means that I have domain over how this segment is run.
Okay.
I do know
who that is.
Anyone on this panel does not know who that is. They deserve some discipline.
Yes. Back of
but
the hand.
What kind of discipline?
To you, the listener, give it your best
don't
guess.
Don't get excited, Rebecca.
Okay, I have a quote, Steve.
All right.
The quote is, those people ask me, why don't I do Bob Dylan songs? And, never mind. Wow, what a coincidence, Evan.
Totally effed that up.
You got to be kidding me. What the hell?
But you know what is exciting?
What?
I saw my first scarlet tanager the other day.
Oh.
Beautiful bird.
Oh, God.
Extremely
no, please.
Beautiful.
I'm so
really?
Bored. Can we please stop?
European or African?
Please stop.
All right, so
anyway,
where was it?
I'm just trying to encourage you to hurry it up with the quote.
I have a quote. This is a quote from Blaise Pascal.
Blaise.
Oh, my God.
he was a French mathematician, a physicist, and a religious philosopher.
And quite the gambler, I understand.
Yes, he gambled. He gambled with his heart, Steve.
And he made a computer program in the 80s.
Yes. He said, men never do evil so completely and cheerfully as when they do it from a religious conviction. Blasé Pascal!
There was nothing blasé about that.
No,
not at all.
Well, thanks, Jay.
You're welcome, Steve.
We have a couple of quick announcements. The first one is that the SGU dinner Friday night at TAM is all booked up, so please do not send us any further registrations. And thanks to everyone who signed up, and we look forward to seeing you there at dinner. The second one is that the Northeastern Conference on Science and Skepticism is now ready for registration. This takes place on September 12th, 2009, this year, an all-day skeptical event with a live SGU show co-hosted by the New York City Skeptics and the New England Skeptical Society with the SGU. Go to www.necsscon.org, nexuscon.org, and there will be event info there as well as a tab to buy your tickets. This will take place at the Florence Gould Hall at the French Institute, 55 East 59th Street, New York, New York, from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m., September 12th. Hope to see many of you there. Sign up quickly. It's actually possible that this may sell out. So if you want to go to that event, be sure to buy your tickets early. Well, thank you all for joining me again this week.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Steve. See you on the plane.
That's true. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and Skeptchick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.